Chapter 47. Francis. They collected everything they could find that would work as a possible lockpick. One hair clip, one belt buckle, one bracelet. It was Francis's bracelet, and she had nothing else to contribute except ignorant enthusiasm, so she stayed out of the way. And the lockpicking committee became Ben, Jessica, Napoleon, Tony, and Carmel. They seemed to be enjoying themselves, destroying her bracelet, and discussing exactly what was needed. Teeth to push the pins out, or some such thing. She went instead to talk to Zoe, who sat in the corner of the room, hugging her knees. "You okay?" Francis asked, sitting down next to her and putting a tentative hand on the curve of her back. Zoe lifted her head and smiled. Her eyes were clear. She looked lovely, not like someone who had spent the previous night tripping. "I'm fine. How was your experience last night?" Frances lowered her voice. "I don't approve of what Marcia did. Outrageous, etc. Your mother is right, drugs are bad, illegal, wrong, just say no and all that. But I have to admit, I'm with Steve Jobs. It was one of the most fantastic experiences of my life. What about you?" "There were good and bad parts," said Zoe. "I saw Zach. We all saw Zach. You know, hallucinated him. We didn't really see him." "I thought I saw him too," said Francis without thinking. Zoe turned her head. "I saw a boy," said Francis, "with you and your mum and dad."
"You saw Zach?"
Zoe's face lit up. "Sorry," said Francis. "I hope you don't think that's disrespectful. Obviously, I never knew your brother. It was just my imagination, creating his image."
"It's fine," said Zoe. "I like that you saw him. You would have liked him. He would have talked to you. He talked to anyone."
She stopped. "I don't mean that in a bad way." "I know what you're saying," Francis smiled.
"He was interested in everyone," said Zoe. "He was like Dad, chatty. He would have asked you about, I don't know, the publishing industry. He was the biggest nerd. He liked watching documentaries, listening to these obscure podcasts. He was fascinated by the world. That's why," her voice broke, "that's why I could never believe he'd choose to give it up."
She banged her chin against her propped up knees. "When he died, we weren't talking. We hadn't been talking for like weeks. We used to have these really big screaming arguments over lots of things. The bathroom, the television, the charger. It all seems stupid now."
"That's what siblings do," said Frances, seeing a flash of her own sister's pursed lips.
"We had this thing where if the fight got really bad, we'd stop talking to each other. And it was like a competition to see who would talk first, and the person who talked first was kind of saying sorry without saying sorry, if you know what I mean. So I didn't want to be the one to talk first."
She looked at Frances as if she were telling her something truly terrible.
"I used to have a very similar arrangement with my first ex-husband," said Francis.
"But I could tell there was something not quite right with him," said Zoe. That week, I could tell, but I didn't ask him. I didn't say anything. I just ignored him.
Frances kept her face neutral. There was no point saying, "You mustn't feel responsible."
Of course she felt responsible. Denying her regret would be like denying her loss.
"I'm so sorry, darling."
She wanted to envelop the child in a big, probably unwelcome hug, but she settled for placing a hand on her shoulder.
Zoe looked over at her mother.
"I've been so angry with him. It felt like he did it on purpose, just to make me feel bad forever, and I couldn't forgive him for that. It just felt like the meanest, cruelest thing he'd ever done to me. But last night, this sounds stupid, but last night, it felt like we'd talked again."
"I know," said Frances. "I talked to my friend Gillian, who died last year, and my dad.
It felt different from a dream. It felt so vivid. It felt realer than real life, to be honest."
"Do you think maybe we really did see them?"
There was so much tremulous hope in Zoe's face.
"Maybe," lied Frances.
It's just I was thinking how Marcia said that after her near-death experience, she realized there was this other reality. And I just thought, maybe we sort of accessed it."
"Maybe," said Frances again. She didn't believe in alternate realities. She believed in the transcendent power of love, memory, and imagination.
"Anything is possible."
Zoe lowered her voice so much that Frances had to lean in close to hear.
"I feel like I've got him back now, in a weird sort of way. Like I could text him if I wanted."
"Ah," said Frances.
"I don't mean I will text him," said Zoe.
"No," said Frances, "of course not. I understand what you're saying. You feel like you're not fighting anymore."
"Yeah," said Zoe. "We made up. I used to always be so relieved when we made up."
They sat in silence for a few comfortable minutes and watched the lock pickers crouch down next to the door.
"By the way, I forgot to tell you, I read your book during the silence," said Zoe. "I loved it."
"You loved it?" said Frances. "Really? It's fine if it wasn't your cup of tea."
"Frances," said Zoe firmly, "it was my cup of tea. I loved it."
"Oh," said Frances. Her eyes stung because she could see that Zoe was telling the truth.
"Thank you."
Chapter 48. Zoe. She lied. The book was so, so sappy. She had finished it yesterday morning. There was nothing else to do here. And it was fine. She kept turning the pages, but you knew from the very beginning that the girl would end up with the guy, even though they hated each other at first, and that there would be trials and tribulations, but it would all work out fine in the end. So what was the actual point of reading it? There was one part where the girl fainted into the guy's arms, which,
like, was romantic or whatever, but did anyone ever really faint in real life? And if they did, was anyone ever really there to conveniently catch them? Also, where was the sex? It took like 300 pages to get to the first kiss, and the book was called Nathaniel's Kiss. Zoe preferred books about international espionage. "I thought it was a fantastic book," she told Frances, perfectly poker-faced. "Your country is depending on you, Zoe." "Maybe you're still high," said Frances. Zoe laughed. Maybe she was. "I don't think so." She couldn't believe she'd got high with her parents. That had been the freakiest part of the whole experience. The fact that her mum and dad were there with her. "Whoa," she kept thinking. "There's mum." "Whoa, there's dad." Worlds collided with volcanic sparks and supersonic booms. She felt like she could spend the rest of her life remembering everything that happened last night. Or it could all disappear. Either way was possible. But one thing that wouldn't change when she left here was her mother's revelation. She and her mother had barely spoken to each other this morning. Right now, she was doing sit-ups. Although Zoe noticed that she was doing them with less aggression than usual. In fact, as Zoe watched, she stopped and lay flat on her back with her hands on her stomach, staring at the ceiling. All these years, Zoe had longed for someone to blame other than herself. After Zach died, she'd been through all of his technology, his phone, his email accounts, his social media. She wanted to find evidence that he'd been bullied, that there was something going on in his life which was nothing to do with her that could explain his decision. But there was nothing. Her dad had done it too. He'd met up with every single one of Zach's friends, interviewing them, trying to understand. But nobody understood. All his friends were devastated, as baffled as his family. Now it seemed possible that there was nothing going on in the outside world. It was all in his head. It was the effects of the asthma medication making him temporarily lose his mind. Maybe. She would never know for sure. Her mother's revelation didn't exonerate Zoe, but it did give her someone with whom to share the blame. For just a moment, she allowed herself the pleasure of hating her mother. Her mother should not have let him take those stupid tablets. Her mother should have read that leaflet, like a responsible mother. Like a mother with medical training. But then she remembered the sound of her mother's scream that morning, and she knew she could never truly blame her. It had been so wrong and almost childish of her mother to keep this a secret. But that very childishness made Zoe feel better. For the first time ever, she saw her mother as just a girl. A girl like her, who made mistakes, who screwed things up, who was just making it all up as she went along. Yes, her mum should have read the leaflet about the side effects, just like Zoe should have gone into her brother's bedroom when she saw him lying on his bed. She should have walked into his room, sat on the end of his bed, grabbed his gigantic foot, given it a shake, and said, "What's wrong with you, loser?" Maybe he would have told her. And if he had told her, and if he'd made it seem serious enough, she would have gone to her dad and said, "Fix it." And her dad would have fixed it. She looked at her dad, the only innocent one in their family, on his hands and knees, peering at the lock. He'd get them out of here. He could fix anything given the opportunity. He just hadn't been given the opportunity to fix Zack. It wasn't okay. It would never be okay. But it felt like hard knots in her stomach were loosening, and she wasn't resisting. Other times, when she'd started to feel better, when she'd found herself laughing or even looking forward to something, she had immediately pulled herself up. She had felt as though getting better would be forgetting him, betraying him. But now it seemed like there might be a way to remember not just the times they fought, but also the times they laughed so hard their faces hurt. To remember the times they stopped talking, but also the times they talked about anything and everything. To remember the secrets they kept from each other, but also the secrets they shared. Zoe studied Frances's profile as she too watched the group of lock pickers. Frances looked younger today, without all that bright red lipstick she wore every day, even when she was doing an exercise class. It was like she thought her red lipstick was a piece of clothing she couldn't be seen without. Zoe felt all at once as if she was Frances, a middle-aged lady who wrote books about romance but fell for a romance scam. And she was her dad, who cried all the time without even knowing he did it, on his knees now trying to pick a lock. And she was her mum, so angry with the world, but mostly with herself for the mistakes she'd made. And she was the hot guy who won the lottery, but didn't seem that happy about it. And she was his wife with the incredible body. And she was the gorgeous gay divorce lawyer. And she was the lady who thought she was fat. And she was the man who used to smile and play football. She was all of them. And she was Zoe. Wow. Maybe she was still high. "It means a lot to me that you liked my book," said Frances, turning to face her, eyes shiny. It was sweet. It seemed like Zoe's opinion really mattered to her. "Well done, kid," said Zack. "Thou droning, dog-hearted dewberry." Zack was still there. He wasn't going anywhere. He was going to stick around while she finished uni and travelled and got a job and got married and got old. Just because he chose death didn't mean Zoe couldn't choose life. He was still there in her heart and her memory, and he was going to stay beside her, keeping her company right until the end. Chapter 49. Ben. They got nowhere trying to pick the lock. Ben could tell straight away that it wasn't going to work. They didn't have the right tools, and the locking mechanism was newly installed. There was some swearing and tetchy remarks. "Well, you try it then." People kept coming up with suggestions for the security code, but that red light kept flashing its mean little "fuck you" rejection signal. Ben hated that red light. He reckoned even his friend Jake, a locksmith, wouldn't be able to do it. He'd once asked Jake if he could pick any lock anywhere. "With the right tools," Jake had answered. They didn't have the right tools. Finally, Ben gave up. He left Carmel and the older men, Napoleon and Tony, to their useless endeavours, and went and sat up against a wall with Jessica, who sat chewing on her false fingernails. She looked at him and smiled tentatively. Her lips were dry and chapped. They had kissed forever last night, in front of people. Sometimes Marcia had been there, sitting right next to them, and they just kept right on kissing, like two horny teenagers on public transport. But it had felt different from being a horny teenager, because there was no end goal. He wasn't doing the kissing just to get to the sex. The kissing was the point. Ben felt like he could have done it forever. It wasn't like sloppy, drunken kissing. It was hyper-real, like every part of his body had been involved. He couldn't pretend he'd hated his first experience of drugs. It had been incredible. Was this what his sister destroyed her life for? Would Ben steal in order to experience that again? He thought about it. No. He still didn't want to do it again, thank God. So he wasn't an addict from that one time he tried drugs. His mother had been telling him that ever since he was 10 years old, her face haggard with worry over his sister. It only takes once, Ben, only once, and your life is ruined. He heard it over and over like a bedtime story. The story was about how the beautiful princess, his sister, got taken away by the evil monster of drugs. You must never, ever, never, ever, never, ever, his mother would say, holding his arm so tight it hurt and looking at him with such terrified intensity he always wanted to look away. But he had to maintain eye contact because if he looked away, she would start the never, ever, never, ever, never, ever chant again. He didn't need his mother to tell him that drugs ruined your life. The evidence was right there, in front of his eyes. He was only 10 when it started, and Lucy was 5 years older. But he still remembered the old Lucy, the first Lucy, the real Lucy who got taken away. The real Lucy played soccer, and she was really good. She sat at the dinner table and ate her dinner and said stuff that made sense and laughed when something was funny, not for hours at a time at nothing. And if she lost her temper, it was normal anger, not the anger that turned her eyes red and mean, like a demon's eyes. She didn't steal, she didn't break things, and she didn't bring home skinny, rat-faced boys with matching red demon eyes. He didn't need to be told never ever, never ever. He knew what the monster did. Ben's poor mother would have a panic attack if she heard he'd been given drugs. It's okay, Ben, said Jessica quietly, as if she'd read his mind. You're not an addict now.
I know that.
He put his hand over hers and wondered if maybe the couple's counselling had worked. Although, if so, why didn't he feel more elated? Maybe it was the crash after the high. That's what got people addicted. The highs were so great, and the lows were so shit in comparison that you'd risk doing anything to get back to the high. He and Jessica had talked. He remembered that. They talked about so much. About everything. Maybe more than they'd ever talked in their entire relationship. They talked about the money. He remembered he'd told her he didn't like the way she'd changed her face and her body. It was strange because that had seemed like such a big deal before. Like the biggest deal ever, And now it seemed like absolutely nothing. Why had it mattered so much? So he didn't like her puffy new lips. Why was that the end of the world? And the car. She'd been the one who scratched the car. That didn't seem to matter much either now. It was like those smoothies had sucked all the air out of their arguments, and now they were all wrinkled and deflated and kind of embarrassing. Like they'd both been making a whole lot of fuss about nothing. There was something else they'd talked about too. Something he thought might have been more significant. He'd remember it in a moment. Jessica pulled out her shirt and sniffed her cleavage. I stink. I'm going to try and have a sponge bath at the bathroom sink. Okay, he said. I need to wash my face, said Jessica. She ran a hand over her cheek. Okay, said Ben. He glanced at her. Not a single person in this room will care if you're not wearing makeup. There will be a single person who cares, said Jessica as she got to her feet. Me. I care. But she didn't seem angry. He watched her walk towards the bathrooms. Are we fixed? Do we have the right tools now? He wanted a bacon and egg McMuffin. He wanted to be at work with the guys listening to FM radio, making cars beautiful again. He was going back to work when they got home. He didn't care if they didn't need the money. He needed the work. How much longer would they be left down here? He had to see Sky. Even when he was working, he never spent a full day without going outside to eat his lunch. He remembered a TV show he'd seen about a guy in jail who might have been wrongfully convicted, and how he told his mother that he hadn't seen the moon in 7 years. Ben experienced a full body chill when he heard that. That poor, poor schmuck. Hey, mind if I sit here? It was Zoe, the girl who was here with her parents. She sat down next to him. When he'd seen her over the last few days, he'd wondered why someone of her age, who was obviously fit and sporty, would choose to come to a place like this. Now he knew. I'm sorry about your brother, he said. She glanced at him. Thank you. She pulled on her ponytail. I'm sorry about your sister. How do you know about my sister? Asked Ben. Your wife mentioned it when we heard about what was in the smoothies yesterday. She said she was an addict. Right, said Ben. I forgot that. It must be hard, said Zoe. She flexed her toes. It's hard for Jessica, said Ben. It's like she has to keep hearing the same old story. She never knew Lucy before the drugs, so to her, she's just a messed up junkie. You never really get anyone else's family, said Zoe. I broke up with my boyfriend because he wanted to go to Bali this week, and I said I couldn't go anywhere. I had to be with my parents for the anniversary of my brother's death. He was like, so are you going to have to spend that week in January with your parents for the rest of your whole life? And I said, yeah.
He sounds like kind of a jerk, said Ben.
It's hard to pick the jerks, said Zoe.
I bet your brother would have picked him for a jerk, said Ben, because it wasn't hard for a guy to pick the jerks. But then he wanted to kick himself. Was that an insensitive thing to say on the anniversary? And maybe her brother wasn't the type to be on the lookout for his sister. But Zoe smiled.
Probably.
What was your brother like? Asked Ben.
He liked science fiction and conspiracy theories and politics and music that no one had ever heard of, said Zoe. He was never boring. We disagreed on basically everything there is to disagree on. For a horrible moment, he thought she might cry, but she didn't. She said, "What was your sister like? Before the drugs? Or beneath the drugs?"
"Beneath the drugs," repeated Ben. He thought about it. Lucy beneath the drugs. "She used to be the funniest person I knew. Sometimes she still is. She's still a person. People treat addicts like they're not real people anymore, but she's still a person." Zoe nodded, just once, almost businesslike, as if she heard what he said and she got it.
"My dad just wanted to cut her off," said Ben. "Have nothing more to do with her. Pretend like she never existed. He said it was a matter of self-preservation."
"How did that work out for him?" asked Zoe.
"It worked out great for him," said Ben. "He left. Mum and Dad got a divorce. He doesn't even ask about Lucy when I see him."
"I guess everyone has, like, different ways of coping with stuff," said Zoe. "After Zach died, my father wanted to talk about him all the time, and my mother couldn't bear to say his name, so..." They sat in silence for a few moments.
"What do you think is going on here?" asked Zoe.
"I don't know," said Ben. "I really don't know."
He watched Jessica walk out of the bathroom. She looked across at Ben and smiled, a bit self-consciously. It would be because she wasn't wearing makeup. These days, he hardly ever saw her without that gunk plastered all over her face. He looked at his wife, and he knew that he loved her. But at the same time, a thought occurred to him. All that kissing wasn't reconnecting. It was saying goodbye.
Chapter 50. Francis. Nobody came. The hours passed as slowly as if they were passengers stuck on a plane, not moving from the tarmac. Everyone kept returning to the keypad and trying out random combinations of numbers over and over. Francis tried the alphabet code with multiple words. LSD, psychedelic, hard to spell, unlock, open, key, health. That red light flashed again and again, and it started to feel personal. Moods began to fluctuate in odd and unexpected ways. Heather became quiet and withdrawn, her limbs floppy. She went to a corner of the room, put three yoga mats on top of each other, curled up on her side, and fell asleep. Lars sang, endlessly.
He had a deep, melodic voice, but he changed from song to song as if someone was turning a dial looking for a particular radio station. Eventually, Tony said abruptly, "Christ almighty, put a sock in it, mate." And Lars looked startled and stopped in the middle of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, as if he hadn't realized he'd been singing for all that time. Carmel made an irregular quack sound by clicking her tongue, and Frances challenged herself to see how long she could put up with it. She was up to 32 quacks when Lars said, "How long do you intend to keep that up for?" Some people exercised. Jessica and Zoe practiced yoga poses together. Ben did an extraordinary number of push-ups and finally stopped, breathing heavily, drenched in sweat. "You should conserve your energy," suggested Napoleon mildly, "while we're fasting." Fasting didn't feel like the right word to Frances. Fasting implied an element of choice. Napoleon didn't speak as much as Frances would have expected. She had thought from their first meeting that he was a talker, but he was quiet and contemplative, frowning at his watch and then glancing up at the camera on the ceiling with a quizzical look, as if to say, "Really? What if something has happened to them?" said Frances eventually. "What if they've all been murdered or kidnapped or fallen ill?" "They've locked us in," said Lars, "so it seems like they planned this." "Maybe they did plan it, but it was just meant to be for an hour or so," said Frances, "and then something terrible happened to them." "If that's the case, we'll be found eventually," said Napoleon. "Our friends and families will notice when we don't return from the retreat."
"So we could be here for another, what, 4-5 days?
Said Frances.
"We'll be so thin," said Carmel.
"I might lose my mind," said Ben.
And his voice sounded shaky, as if it were already happening.
"At least we have running water," said Napoleon, "and bathrooms. It could be worse."
"It could be better," said Tony. "Room service would help."
"I love room service," said Frances.
"Room service and a movie," sighed Tony.
They locked eyes, and Frances looked away first because she was accidentally imagining herself in a hotel room with him. Those tattoos on his butt as he came out of the shower. That smile. She gave herself a mental slap across the cheek and thought of her dad, sighing,
"You were always so crazy about the boys."
52 years old. And still no sense.
Just because they both liked room service didn't mean they were compatible. What would they talk about while they ate their room service? Football?
"We'll offer them money," said Jessica suddenly, "to let us out. Everyone has a price, right?"
"How much?" said Ben.
"A million? 2 million?
"Steady on," said Lars.
"They're not going to let you out on a promise," said Tony.
But Jessica had already walked to the middle of the room and was addressing the camera.
"We're prepared to pay a fee to get out of here, Marsha."
She jammed her fists into her waist.
"Money is no issue for us. We've got no shortage of cash. Honestly, we're happy to pay for an upgrade. We want to skip this part of the program, thanks, and we're happy to pay a penalty."
She looked around the room uncomfortably. For everyone, that is. We'll cover the cost for everyone to get out.
Nothing happened.
I don't think Marcia is motivated by money, said Napoleon quietly. Frances thought, what does motivate her? She remembered her counselling session and the way Marcia's eyes had lit up when she spoke of how the VCR had once been a window into another world. But presumably movies no longer interested her. She definitely wanted Frances to know that Australia needed her brains. Approval? Admiration? Was that it? Or was it love? Was it that simple? She just wanted love, like everyone did. But some people had such a peculiar way of manifesting that need.
We don't even know if they're watching us, said Lars. Maybe they've all got their feet up somewhere and they're watching Orange is the New Black.
We did not pay for shared accommodation. Jessica jabbed her finger up at the camera. I'm not sleeping in here again tonight. We paid for a double room and I want to be back in my room. I'm hungry. I'm tired.
She lifted up a strand of her hair and smelled it. And I need to wash my hair right now.
Oh, my God.
Ben put both his hands on his temples. He ran about in a comical half circle.
I just remembered what you said. You're pregnant. You said last night you were pregnant.
Oh, yeah, said Jessica, turning to her husband. I forgot. Chapter 51. Delilah.
She's not pregnant.
Yao's face was pasty with panic.
She is absolutely not pregnant.
Delilah, Marcia, and Yao were in Marcia's office, watching the live CCTV footage of their guests in the meditation room.
I would never have allowed a pregnant woman to take those substances, said Yao. Never.
So why does she keep saying she is? Asked Marcia. They'd been here for hours. Marcia and Yao stood and paced as they watched, but Delilah had finally sat down in Marcia's chair. Delilah was tired and hungry and kind of over it. Maybe she was kind of over being a wellness consultant. 4 years now, and the guests were all starting to blend together. They were all so self-absorbed. And sometimes she felt like she was a minor character in a story about everyone except her. Over the years, only a handful of guests had ever asked Delilah a single question about herself. Which, fine, the guests didn't have to talk to her at all if they didn't want. But they all assumed she would be so fascinated by them. The things they told her about their marriages, their sex lives, their bowels. If she had to hear another story about someone's irritable bowel syndrome, she would slash her wrists. And then there were the complaints that came thick and fast, the softness of their pillows, the temperature of their rooms, the weather. Like she could control the weather. It was nice when people seemed to truly believe they were transformed at the end of a retreat. But Delilah wasn't quite as evangelical about this whole transformation business as Marcia and Yao. Yes, she enjoyed yoga. Her core strength was excellent. She had a six-pack and she liked having a six-pack. Meditation was relaxing.
Mindfulness was great, and she had no problem introducing drugs into the equation. That made life interesting. And sure, it might give people some insights into their psyches, although honestly, most of their psyches didn't seem that, you know, complex. This wasn't God's work. This was a health resort. Delilah was skilled at giving the impression she cared as much as Marsha and Yao. She could talk the talk, walk the walk. God, she'd done it with dairy products when she was Marsha's executive PA. Yes, yes, I'm just passionate about yogurt. Then after Marsha's heart attack, she'd left dairy and done it with insurance. All those years working as a PA had been great training to be a wellness consultant. Nod and smile and agree and make things happen behind the scenes and don't ask questions unless absolutely necessary. Marsha paid well. Delilah had nearly reached her savings goal. She was going to travel for a year. I did pregnancy tests for all the women, said Yao. Even the older women. She's not pregnant. So why did she say she was? Asked Marsha again. I don't know, said Yao. He was very upset, almost in tears. So she can sue us for giving her drugs? Said Delilah. She doesn't need money. Marsha gestured at the screen. Like she said, money is no issue. Delilah shrugged and sighed. Maybe she just wants to make a point, like, what if I was pregnant and you gave me drugs? She's not pregnant, said Yao again. She doesn't know we know that, said Delilah. And her husband's sister is an addict, so, you know, they're really anti-drugs. Pity we didn't know that. Marsha swung around. But they should be happy. Their therapy went so well. They kissed. That's because they were high, said Delilah. Sometimes Marsha had a bizarre innocence to her. Did she really think the kissing between those two meant something? They kissed for a very long time, said Marsha to Delilah. Yes, said Delilah. That's what happens when you take ecstasy. That's why they call it the love drug. The first time Delilah took ecstasy, she kissed Ryan, her boyfriend at the time, for over 2 hours straight. And it was incredible kissing, the best kissing of her entire life to date. But it didn't mean she wanted to marry the pompous British twat with his tight purple shirts. It was just kissing. It wasn't just the drug, said Marsha. I led them to many important breakthroughs. Said Delilah. Like all of Delilah's bosses ever, Marsha was a total narcissist. Delilah found it hilarious when Marsha spoke so solemnly to guests about the dissolving of the ego, as if her giant-sized ego could ever be dissolved. Over the last few years, Delilah had observed Marsha's ego flourish. Nurtured by the guests who hung on her every word and the dog-like devotion of Yao. I have a gift for this, she said, straight-faced, when, really, what the hell would Marsha know about relationships? In all these years, Delilah had never known her to be in one. Delilah couldn't tell if she was straight or gay or bi, or just had no sexual orientation whatsoever. I thought they would be more positive at this stage of their journeys, said Marsha. More grateful.
Delilah exchanged a look with Yao. Wow. That was almost an acknowledgement of a mistake. At the very least, it was the acknowledgement of a moment of doubt. Yao looked terrified, as if his whole world were falling apart. The dude was obsessed with Marcia, probably in love with her. Delilah couldn't tell if his interest was sexual. It was more like the way a superfan behaves around a rock star, as if he couldn't quite believe he was allowed in the same room as her. "It will all be fine," said Marcia to Yao. "We just need to carefully consider how we proceed." "We should feed them," said Delilah. She knew this from her waitressing days. "Get some complimentary garlic bread out to the table. Stuff them with carbs, and they'll stop complaining about the long wait on their mains." "It hasn't even been 48 hours yet," said Marcia. "They all knew the retreat would include fasting." "Yes, but they didn't know it would include LSD, said Delilah, "or being locked up." She thought that Marcia had badly overestimated her guests' commitment to transformation. When people said they came to Tranquillum House to be enlightened, what they really meant was skinnier. Anyway, as far as Delilah could see, no one in that room looked particularly transformed. There was no way in hell Heather Marconi was coming out of that room and giving them a 5-star review on TripAdvisor. Marcia, being Marcia, had never doubted that this new protocol was going to be a success. She had no concerns about the issue of consent. She said it was too risky to ask for it because the ones who most needed help would be the ones most likely to refuse. The glorious ends would justify the means. No one would complain once they experienced their personal transformations. "Let's keep our focus on solutions," said Marcia now, as she contemplated her guests moving about their temporary prison. She didn't even look that tired. Delilah remembered a night, more than 10 years earlier, when she was working as Marcia's PA. Someone had discovered a major error in their analysis for the budget they were presenting to the board of directors the following day. Marcia had worked 30 hours straight, right through the night, without stopping, to rectify the error. Delilah had stayed in the office with her, but she'd had a couple of power naps to keep herself going. The presentation was a triumph. 6 months later, Marcia had her heart attack. 5 years after that, when Delilah had honestly kind of forgotten Marcia's existence, she called to ask Delilah if she'd like to train as a wellness consultant at a health resort she was starting up. Marcia liked to tell guests that they would hear about Delilah's supposed wellness journey, but they never heard about it because there was no wellness journey. Delilah resigned from her job as PA for the chief executive douchebag at an insurance company. Her wellness journey was basically a train ride from Central Station to Jarrabong. "I think we should let them out," said Yao. "They were meant to be out by now."
"We have to be ready to adapt," said Marcia. "I told you both that at the beginning. For dramatic results, you need dramatic action. I know this is uncomfortable for them, but that's the only way people change. They have water. They have shelter. We are taking them out of their comfort zone. That's all. That's when growth occurs."
"I'm just not sure that this is right," fretted Yao.
Turn up the audio, said Masha.
Obviously, we're obligated to report this to the police as soon as we're out, said a woman.
Who's that? Said Masha.
Francis, said Yao, his eyes on the screen. Francis had her back to them. She was talking to Lars.
Francis, said Masha. She loved her experience. She seemed to get so much out of it.
Lars was saying, morally obligated, legally obligated. We've got a duty of care. They'll kill someone eventually if we don't.
I don't know if I'd want them to do actual jail time, said Francis. I think their intentions were good.
Right now, I'm deprived of my liberty, Francis, said Lars. I'm not too worried if someone does a little jail time for this.
Oh, God,
Yao moaned into his knuckles. It's a disaster. They're not even trying.
It's not a disaster, said Masha. They'll work it out. It's just taking a little longer than we expected.
They don't seem any different after the therapy, said Yao. They just seem so angry.
Delilah suppressed a sigh. It's called a hangover, you fools.
She said, would anyone like a green tea?
Thank you, Delilah. That's very thoughtful, said Masha gratefully.
And she touched Delilah on the arm and smiled that soul-warming smile.
Even before, when Masha didn't look anything like a goddess, when she was just a frumpy, high-level executive who was really good at her job, she had charisma. You wanted to please her. Delilah had worked harder for Masha than she'd ever worked for anyone. But now it was time to close this chapter in her life. Clearly, the police were going to be involved. Delilah had been the one to access the drugs on the dark web, a process she had enjoyed, and a new skill to add to her CV, along with PowerPoint. She thought her actions probably wouldn't be enough for her to go to jail, but they might be, and she felt like she wouldn't enjoy jail. Part of her had known all along it was going to come to this. There was a kind of inevitability to it. From the moment Masha had first handed her the book about psychedelic therapy and said, "This is going to revolutionize the way we do business." Delilah remembered thinking, "This won't end well." But she'd been feeling bored for a while. Experimenting with drugs was interesting, and she'd kind of wanted to see the train wreck. They microdosed guests' smoothies for over a year without ill effects. People had no idea. They believed it was the organic food and meditation that caused them to feel so great. They rebooked because they wanted to feel that great again. Then Masha decided she wanted to do more than microdosing. She wanted to do something revolutionary. She wanted to push the envelope. She said they would be changing the course of history. Yao had argued. He didn't want to change the course of history. He just wanted to help people. Masha said this would be helping people in a way that would truly change their lives forever. The clincher had been when he'd tried the psychedelic therapy himself, with Masha as his guide. Delilah hadn't been there. It was her weekend off. But when she saw Yao next, he had an even crazier, more obsessive blaze in his eyes than before, and he was quoting from the research as if it was the research that had changed his mind
when it was just the power of hallucinogenic drugs and the power of Marsha. Obviously, Delilah tried the psychedelic therapy too. Her experience had been awesome, but she wasn't stupid enough to think any of those feelings or so-called revelations were real. They were just drugs. She'd done magic mushrooms before. It was like mistaking lust for love, or thinking that the sentimental feelings you got when you heard a certain song were genuine. Get real. Those feelings were manufactured. When Yao had gone on and on about what he'd supposedly learned from his psychedelic therapy, she kind of wanted to slap him. It was just another example of how that sweet, stupid boy was addicted to Marsha. He was a lost cause. Nothing was ever going to change there. Delilah didn't go to the kitchen to make green tea. She went straight to her room and collected her ID. Everything else about this particular life, the white uniforms, the sandalwood scent, her yoga mat, she left behind. Ever since she joined the workforce, she'd known this about herself. She was, at heart, a PA. The smoother of the way, like a butler or a lady in waiting. Someone seen and not heard. She wasn't the captain of this ship, and she sure as hell wasn't going down with it. Within 5 minutes, she was behind the wheel of Ben's Lamborghini, driving towards the nearby regional airport, where she would take the next available flight, wherever it was going. The car drove like a dream. Chapter 52. Jessica. "How far along are you?" asked Heather from her position in the corner of the room. She sat up and rubbed her knuckles so hard into the sockets of her eyes that Jessica winced. You needed to be careful with the delicate skin around your eyes.
Let's see. 2 days, answered Jessica. She put a hand to her stomach.
2 days, said Carmel. Do you mean your period is 2 days late?
No, I'm not late yet, said Jessica.
So you haven't done a test?
No, said Jessica. Geez, what was with the Spanish Inquisition? How could I?
This was so weird. All of them standing around in this small room like they were at an office party, but they were talking about her periods.
So you might not be pregnant? asked Ben.
Jessica couldn't tell if his shoulders dropped with relief or disappointment.
I am, said Jessica.
What makes you think so? asked Carmel.
I just know, said Jessica. I could tell as soon as it happened.
You mean you knew at the moment of conception? said Carmel.
Jessica saw her exchange a look with Heather, as if to say, can you believe this shit?
Older women could be so condescending.
Well, you know, some mothers do say they could tell they were pregnant at the moment of conception, said Heather kindly.
Maybe she is.
I bet a lot of women think they know, and then it turns out they're wrong, said Carmel.
What's the big deal? said Jessica. Why did this strange, fuzzy-haired woman sound so angry with her? I mean, I know we weren't meant to be touching during the silence.
She glanced up at the silent, dark eye of the camera watching them.
We weren't meant to be taking drugs, either.
The sex had happened in the dark on their second night at the retreat.
not a word spoken. It was all blind, silent touch, and it had been raw and real, and afterwards she lay awake and felt a wave of peace wash over her. Because if their marriage was over, so be it. But now there was going to be a baby, and even if they didn't love each other anymore, the baby was created from a moment of love. But wait, she's on the pill, said Ben to Heather and Carmel, as if Jessica weren't even there. Can that happen? Only abstinence is 100% effective, but if she's... Heather looked at Jessica. If you've been taking the pill every day at the same time, it's probably unlikely that you're pregnant. Jessica sighed. I went off the pill 2 months ago. Ah, said Heather. Without telling me, said Ben. You went off the pill without telling me. Uh-oh, said Lars quietly. You didn't mention this last night, said Ben, when we were speaking from our hearts. He sarcastically quoted Marcia, his face stone hard. And Jessica thought about last night and how their words had flowed like water. But she hadn't told him last night about going off the pill. She'd still kept secrets, even when she was high, because she'd known it was a betrayal. She should have said it last night when his face was all soft and she felt like they were two halves of one person. She'd felt like that was a beautiful truth the drugs had helped her discover. But it had been a beautiful lie. Yeah, said Jessica. She lifted her chin and remembered the kissing, and how, as they kissed, a single thought had blinked on and off like a neon sign in her head. We're okay. We're okay. We're okay. But they weren't okay. Nothing she'd thought last night had been real. It was all just drugs. Drugs lied. Drugs fucked you up. She and Ben knew that better than anyone. Sometimes Ben's mother sat and cried over the pictures of Lucy before she fell for the lies of drugs. Now that was a transformation. Don't waste your money on this stupid retreat, Jessica's own mother had said before they came here. Give all that money to charity and go back to work. Then your marriage will be just fine. You'll have something to talk about at the end of the day. Her mother seriously thought Jessica could go back and work in that shit-kicker job when she now earned more in bank interest in just 1 month than she used to earn in a whole year. Jessica couldn't make her mother understand that once you had that much money, you were changed forever. You were worth more. You were better than that. You couldn't go back because you could never see yourself that way again. Rationally, she knew it was just dumb luck that had got her rich. But deep, deep down, an insistent voice in her head told her, I deserve this. I was meant for this. I am this person. I was always this person. Oh dear, take it from someone who knows. Getting pregnant is not the best way to try to save a marriage, said Carmel. Well, thanks, but I wasn't trying to save my marriage, said Jessica. What were you trying to do, Jess? Asked Ben quietly. And for a moment it was like last night. Just the two of them together in their little boat, floating down a river of ecstasy.
I wanted a baby, said Jessica. She was going to document her journey on Instagram. Sideways shots of her baby bump. A stylish gender reveal party. Blue or pink balloons would fly out of a box. Hopefully pink. People would put heart emojis in the comments. I was scared you'd say no, she told Ben. I thought if we were going to break up, I'd better hurry up and get pregnant.
Why would I say no? We always said we'd have children, said Ben.
Yes, I know, but that was before we started to have issues, said Jessica. She couldn't have borne to hear him say, are you kidding? Us?
So this baby isn't anything to do with me, said Ben. You assumed we were breaking up and wanted to have a baby on your own.
Of course it's to do with you, said Jessica. I only wanted your baby.
She could see him soften, but then, idiotically, without thinking, she said,
you're the father. You can see it whenever you want.
I can see it whenever I want? Exploded Ben.
You would think she'd said the worst thing in the world. Gee, thanks.
No, I didn't mean... I just meant... God! Their words no longer flowed like water. Now their conversation stopped and started in hard little jabs.
It's probably premature to be sorting out access visits, said Lars.
I doubt she's even pregnant, said Carmel.
I am pregnant, insisted Jessica. I just hope these drugs haven't hurt the baby.
You won't be the first or the last to have got drunk or high in the very early days of pregnancy, said Heather. I'm a midwife, and the things some mothers have admitted to me, especially when the partners have left the room. If you are pregnant, there's a good chance your baby will be fine.
So much for being the anti-drug crusader, Mum, said Zoe.
Well, there's nothing to be done now, said Heather under her breath, although Jessica could hear her perfectly well.
I've been taking folate tablets, Jessica told her.
That's great, said Heather.
Yep, so great. Folate, a little LSD, and some ecstasy, said Ben bitterly. The perfect start to life.
Don't worry about it. She's probably not even pregnant, said Carmel in a low voice.
What is your fucking problem?
Jessica's voice rose to an embarrassingly high pitch. She knew she shouldn't be swearing and showing her emotions like this, but she felt suddenly very upset.
Hey now, said Napoleon soothingly.
Frances, the romance author, plonked herself down and went bright red in the face, as if she'd never heard the F word in her life.
Sorry, said Carmel. She lowered her head. It's probably just envy.
Envy? You're like jealous of me, said Jessica. Wasn't this woman too old to feel jealous?
Why?
Well, Carmel laughed a little.
The money, thought Jessica. She's jealous of the money.
It had taken her a while to realize that people of any age, people she considered grown-ups of her parents' generation, who you'd think wouldn't care that much about money because their lives were virtually done, could still be jealous and weird about it.
Well,
You're thin and beautiful, said Carmel. I know it's embarrassing to admit this at my age. I've got four beautiful daughters. I should be way beyond this. But my husband left me for a...
bimbo,
suggested Lars. Sadly not. She's got a PhD, said Carmel. Oh, honey, you can still be a bimbo with a PhD, said Lars. Who represented you? I assume you're still in the family home. It's fine, thank you. I'm not complaining about the settlement. She stopped and looked at Jessica. You know what? I'm probably jealous of you being pregnant. Haven't you got four children? Said Lars. That seems like more than enough. I don't want any more children, said Carmel. I just want to go back in time to when everything was beginning. Pregnancies are the ultimate beginnings. She put a hand to her stomach. I always felt beautiful when I was pregnant, although I must admit my hair looked preposterous. I've got all this thick black Romanian hair, so when I was pregnant, it went wild. Wait, why did it go wild? Asked Jessica. She was not prepared for her hair to go wild, thank you very much. Surely there was a shampoo and conditioner to fix that. Your hair stops falling out when you're pregnant, said Heather. So it gets thicker. She touched her own hair. I loved my hair when I was pregnant. I'm sure you are pregnant, Jessica, said Carmel, and I'm sorry. She paused. Congratulations. Thank you, said Jessica. Maybe she wasn't pregnant. Maybe she'd just made a fool of herself in front of these people. She looked at Ben. He was studying his bare feet as if they had the answer. He had huge feet. Would their baby have huge feet too? Could they really be parents together? They weren't too young. They could afford a baby. They could afford a dozen babies. Why did it seem unimaginable? Tony had gone to the bathroom and come back with a damp towel that he wordlessly handed to Frances. She pressed it to her forehead. She was sweating. Are you not well, Frances? Asked Carmel. Everyone looked at Frances. No, said Frances. She waved a languid hand in front of her face. Just, you know how you talked about how much you liked beginnings? I've got my own personal ending going on here. Ah, said Heather, as if that made perfect sense to her. Don't think of it as an ending. Think of it as a beginning. Carmel said, when I was a teenager, my mother used to wear this badge that said, they're not hot flushes, they're power surges. I was absolutely mortified by it. The three of them laughed that self-satisfied, middle-aged woman laugh that made you want to stay young forever. Chapter 53. Frances. You all right? Tony sat on the floor next to Frances, in that uncomfortable way men sat on the ground at picnics, as if they were looking for somewhere to stow their legs. I'm okay, said Frances. She pressed the damp towel to her forehead as the wave of heat continued to engulf her. She felt strangely sanguine, even though she was locked in a room with strangers and having a hot flush.
Thanks for the towel. She studied him. His face was pale, and there were beads of sweat across his forehead too. Are you okay? He patted his forehead.
Just a bit claustrophobic.
You mean, like, properly claustrophobic?
Not just, I really want to get out of here claustrophobic.
Frances let the towel drop to her lap. Tony tried to bend his knees up towards his chest, gave up, and stretched them out again.
I'm mildly claustrophobic. It's not that big a deal. I didn't like being down here even before we were locked in.
Right then, I need to distract you, said Frances. Take your mind off it.
Go right ahead, said Tony.
He smiled a half version of his full-on smile. So, said Frances. She thought about what Napoleon had said yesterday before their smoothies had their full effect. Did you suffer from that post-sports depression when you gave up football?
That's a really sparkling topic of conversation to hit off with, said Tony.
Sorry, said Frances, I'm not at my best. Also, I'm interested. My career might be kind of ending right now.
Tony grimaced. Well, they say that a sports star dies twice. The first time is when they retire.
And was it like a death? Asked Frances. It would feel like a death if she had to stop writing.
Well, yeah. Kind of.
He picked up a half-melted candle and pulled off a chunk of wax.
Not to be dramatic about it, but the game was all I knew for all those years. It's who I was. I was a kid straight out of school when I started playing professionally. My ex-wife would say I was still a kid when I finished. She used to say it stunted me. She had this phrase she'd picked up somewhere. Professional sports person, amateur human being.
He put the candle back on the floor and flicked away the piece of wax with his fingertips.
She used to repeat it every time I demonstrated my amateur approach to life.
There was a hurt look in his eyes that belied his light, humorous tone. Frances decided his ex-wife was a witch.
Also, I wasn't ready to finish up. I thought I had one season left in me, but my right knee thought otherwise.
He pulled up one leg and pointed at the offending knee.
Stupid right knee, said Frances.
Yeah, I was pissed off with it. Tony massaged his knee. A sports doctor friend told me that retiring is like coming off cocaine. Your body is used to all those feel-good chemicals, serotonin, dopamine, and bam, suddenly they're gone and your body has to readjust.
I don't think I've ever experienced those feel-good chemicals doing exercise, admitted Frances.
She picked up the candle he'd discarded and dug her thumbnail into the soft wax near the wick.
You probably have, said Tony, doing certain types of exercise.
He paused. She blinked.
Wait, was that innuendo?
He continued talking. Maybe she'd got it wrong. You probably find this laughable, but there were some games where we were all where we were meant to be,
and we all did what we were meant to do, and it all just came together like a piece of music or poetry or, I don't know. He met her eyes and winced, as if preparing himself for derision. Sometimes it felt transcendent, like drugs. It really did.
That's not laughable, said Francis. That makes me want to take up AFL.
He gave a deep, appreciative chuckle. My ex-wife used to say that all I ever thought about was the game. It probably wasn't much fun being married to me.
Oh, I'm sure it was, said Frances without thinking, and caught herself staring at his massive shoulders. She changed the subject hurriedly.
So, what did you do after you stopped playing? How did you recreate yourself?
I set up a sports marketing consultancy, said Tony. It's done well, you know, for a business run by an amateur human being. I thought I was doing better than a lot of my teammates. Some of them really fucked up. I mean, stuffed up their lives.
I feel like fucked up is the correct phrase to use there, said Francis. He gave her his full smiley grin. It really was the funniest smile.
You're kind of annihilating that candle, he said.
She looked guiltily at the mess of wax in her lap.
You started it.
She brushed the wax onto the floor. Go on.
So you set up this consultancy.
I had one friend who said to me, don't you hate the way that everyone only wants to talk about who you used to be? But I honestly never minded that. I liked it when people recognized me. I never mind talking about the man I used to be. But anyway, late last year I started to get these symptoms, this incredible fatigue. I just felt something was wrong, even before I got on Dr. Google.
Frances felt herself go cold. She was at an age where people in her circle didn't imagine serious illnesses. They got them.
And?
So I took myself off to my GP, and he ran a lot of tests, and I could tell he was taking it seriously, and I said, are you thinking pancreatic cancer? Because that's what I was thinking. That's how I lost my dad, and I know it runs in families. And the GP gave me this look. I've known him for years. And he said, I'm covering all bases. Oh, damn it to hell. It was just before Christmas. And he called me in to give me the results. He pulled out the file. And afterwards, I realized I had these words in my head and I was saying them to myself, and it just shocked the life out of me that I would think that.
What words? Asked Francis.
I was thinking, let it be terminal.
Francis blanched. And, but, is it?
Duh, I'm fine, said Tony. Nothing wrong with me, except that I obviously don't have a healthy lifestyle.
Francis exhaled. She hoped not excessively. Well, thank goodness. But it shook me up that I would think that I would hope for a terminal diagnosis. I thought, mate, how fucked up is your head?
Yeah, that's bad, said Frances.
She felt energized in that bossy female way that she knew drove men crazy,
But there was really nothing you could do about it once you felt that sense of righteousness surge through you. Because they were such idiots. So, right, you've got to get this fixed. You need, he held up his hand, I've got it under control. It's really very bad that you thought that. I know it is. That's why I'm here. So you probably need, he put his finger to his lips. Shh. Therapy, she got in quickly. Shh. And zip it. Frances zipped it. She held the wet towel to her face to hide her smile. At least he wasn't thinking about his claustrophobia now. Tell me about this bastard who scammed you, said Tony. And then, tell me where he lives.